Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Just want to thank our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. They remind you that every bite has a story. So whether it's a tomato, muffin, T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. Because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make helps us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. I'm slightly intimidated by our next guest, the prolific Joshua David Stein, a fellow three-namer. Joshua is the senior editor at Eater National, has written for an array of magazines, t-shirt designer, we'll talk about that, and most recently did some excellent coverage in Lyon, France for the U.S. Beaucoup d'Or team. And I think we're going to jump right into that. Right before I ask, the picture that you sent me for the website, were you in front of Prince's Hot Chicken?
I was indeed.
You son of a bitch. How excellent was it?
It was very excellent.
Oh, man, my brother lives in that northern eastern part of Alabama, and I was almost just going to take a drive to Nashville for that.
It's worthwhile. The only thing that mitigates its excellence is there's a big poster of Guy Fieri being a douchebag.
He's been on Double D, Triple D, whatever that show's called.
What's
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives?
He's the worst. Yeah. It makes me angry to see his face.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just on AM, on the front page of AM Metro.
Really?
For a minute to win it.
Okay, I do love that game.
You do?
More of the scratch-off ticket than actual TV show.
Right.
Just because I'm addicted to scratch-off tickets, but it's a fascinating thing.
I feel like the game is embodies everything wrong with human nature.
Really? I can't just become successful without doing anything in 1 minute?
Well, it's being debased on national television for greed.
Yeah, yeah.
By a douchebag.
By a douchebag. Aside from douchebaggery, food. Beaucoup d'Or. I think I'll give you the platform and so you could explain to people exactly what the Beaucoup d'Or competition is.
Right. Well, it's named after Paul Bocuse, who's the obviously a very well-known and respected chef based in Lyon, who's, I think, 84 now. And it's a very rigorous culinary competition that happens every 2 years, starting in, I believe, 1987. And it's over the course of 2 days. And each team, there's 24 countries, each team has to present two platters. And the only thing that they tell you is what proteins you'll have to use. This year, it was monkfish for the fish.
Yeah.
Avi. And lamb for the meat.
Do they tell you kind of like Iron Chef or Chopped, like right before you open the baskets? No?
No. They announce it quite early on. Team USA, I know, had been working on their dishes for, I think, 15 months. So
wow.
There's a lot of time to prepare.
Yeah.
You have to do a protein and you need three garnishes on the plate.
Wow. Those seem kind of very open-ended at the same point. So interpretation is a, no.
It's great. I mean, it's, I think it has just enough rules to make it interesting and not too many to make it feel arbitrary. In terms of philosophy, how you present it, all those things are completely open. Although there's a lot of, obviously, very classic, traditional French preparations.
Yeah, and we'll kind of talk about how things are judged and the mind's eye of the U.S. team a little bit later. This year, represented by James Kent and Tom Allen of 11 Madison Park. And you met James in Lyon. Had you met him before?
I don't think I had. I met Gavin Kaysen, who was a coach.
Yeah.
And a former competitor.
Yeah, the chef at Café Boulud now.
Yes. Right. I met him at a hilarious game dinner at Danielle.
Yeah.
To raise money for Team USA.
What was so hilarious about game?
Well, it was a $500 dinner.
Yeah.
And it was a room full of very wealthy individuals eating, you know, hare, duck, all those things. And there was a kind of a giveaway, raffle type thing, pub quiz.
Yeah.
Put on by D'Artagnan, Ariane de Dagon.
Dagon.
And one of the questions was, who's representing the United States? Which I thought was a pretty easy
yeah.
question, and that was for the grand prize. And no one raised their hand. So after, you know, maybe 45 very long seconds, I raised my hand and I said, James Kent. Purely out of selfless desire to fill the void of silence and ignorance. And so I have a fridge full of, you know, truffle butter and duck liver and...
Oh, man. Ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance pays.
Yeah. Okay, that shows right there how aware are, you know, citizens of this country of the Beaucoup d'Or. I mean, with all this celebrity chefdom and Guy Fieri being posterized everywhere.
Not very. It's only the last three competitions, really, that America has, in some level, become more aware of it. Michael Ruhlman, who I was in Lyon with, brought up the good point that competition, there's not a very strong tradition of competition and competitive cooking in the United States. In France, you have the MOF, the Meilleur Ouvrier de France, in a variety of disciplines. And while that's not technically a competition like the Bocuse d'Or is, it's sort of a technique for technique's sake endeavor. And in the United States, competition cooking is largely seen the domain of hotel and catering chefs, chefs who don't have restaurants, chefs who aren't maybe making it in the hurly-burly world of commerce.
Chefs who are cooking for, you know, 100, 200, 300 seat, not boutique, not...
Exactly.
Yeah.
That said, this year, Team USA, there's a foundation behind it called the Bocuse d'Or USA Foundation, had raised quite a bit of money, and the infrastructure is as I said, building, and awareness is building to some extent. I think because the United States didn't finish very well this year, interest might not be sustained, but I hope it will be.
I mean,
it's not a direct rise.
Yeah, but I mean, look at some of the people behind Bocuse d'Or here in this country. You said game dinner at, you know, Daniel Boulud's restaurant. You have him. Thomas Keller is on the board. There are some other pretty mighty chefs that are trying to back this.
The Culinary Council, which is, I think, 24 or 21 chefs from around the country who get together with Team USA, which is mostly Daniel, Thomas, James, Gavin. I think his name's Mark Erickson from CIA. This panel of chefs, you know, really contributes and helps and gives feedback. And that's everyone from Grant Achatz to Eric Siebold and everyone in between.
Excellent.
Chefs, I think, in the industry.
Oh, I see what you just did there from A to Z.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
It's good, right?
Yeah, very good.
It's the only two names I know, so. Certainly within the industry, it's becoming more respected. And the other thing is Paul Bocuse is so well known and well loved. That's why Thomas Keller got involved. He said, Thomas, will you please be a judge? So a lot of it is in honor or out of respect for Chef Bocuse.
Yeah. I'm actually in the middle, almost finished reading Au Revoir. That was terrible French. To all that, I think it's Michael Sternberg's book about French cuisine, you know, from your to contemporary, and how many people cite, you know, Paul. Oh, that seems wrong to say just Paul.
Big P.
Yeah. Chef Bocuse, as their mentor or as their idol. Almost feels like it doesn't show as much in New York that there aren't fountainheads here like there used to be. Obviously, there's Thomas Keller. Obviously, there's Daniel Boulud, but it feels partitioned sometimes, and I don't know if that muddies the view or camaraderie of a U.S. team, or, you know, everyone else is trying to do their own little boutique-y thing and aren't necessarily going for the greater good of the country.
I mean, I don't know whether Paul Bocuse was a great chef for France or if he was just a great chef and it happened that his cuisine became totemic and his influence felt worldwide.
Yeah.
But I do know that he's respected immensely among all the kind of top, well, everyone, but very much so among the top tier chefs in America.
Yeah. Did you meet Bocuse?
I met him, but he's quite old, and it's amazing. I met him as he was walking, inspecting the boxes, is what they call the little kitchens where the teams compete. And I've never seen a media scrum as frantic as that. And, you know, he doesn't speak very much, and he's very kind of slow. He's old, but he's a superstar. I think in a way that in America isn't known. We have celebrity chefs, but they're mostly known, yes, for their cuisine, but through different media. Paul Bocuse is known just for being Paul Bocuse.
He's like a bedtime story.
Yeah. Through Ratatouille, perhaps, he's known most.
Yeah. Being there, so it's a two-day event, 24 teams. What happens? I mean, what is the entry point to the competition?
Well, something I didn't know, and I think most people might not know, is the Bocuse d'Or is just one aspect of this huge restaurant and hospitality association trade show called CIRHA, S-I-R-H-A. So it's in this ginormous convention center that puts Javits to shame. And Bocuse d'Or is you walk through, you know, booths for stemware and ham and toothpick holders, and you come into this big auditorium. The Bocuse d'Or, it's 2 days because there's 12 teams per day. And then at the end of that, the end of the second day, they announce the winner. So as a spectator, I can't believe people do it, that you're in the stands watching this cooking that you can't really tell what's going on.
Yeah.
And yelling crazily for eight hours.
What are some of the cheers that happen in the crowd?
There's mostly a lot of yelling. I think one team had a drum line. And
because all these chefs that cook in these elite restaurants are used to drum lines.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, usually here it's bloggers. Yeah. And it's a and it's a chorus of
the keypad.
The keypad. Let's see. Oh, there is a lot of noisemakers. I think the Swiss had a fair amount of cowbells.
Yeah.
Which is typical of the Swiss. And some horrible country had air horns, and they were making liberal use.
Laws?
No, they strangely no.
Okay.
Although South Africa was not competing.
So yeah.
There you have it. As a spectator, I'm not sure exactly how thrilling it is. I feel like a lot of people are there just to support their country, and it's an act of patriotism more than a spectator sport.
Yeah.
But it is thrilling nonetheless.
Yeah. And
especially if you know the story and you know how hard these guys are working, and you know, I guess I didn't have the badge, but I jumped over the barricade and I could see, you know, Gavin up there doing the prep and all that stuff, or directing the prep, because he's not allowed in the small box. He had to stand on the other side. And he had a list broken down maybe in 5-minute increments about everything they had to do for the entire 5 hours, 35 minutes that they had to prepare the dishes. So that added some drama. You know, you saw that, you know, start sous viding the loin, or, you know.
I don't know if you want me to put the caveat out there that your cooking knowledge isn't as deep and, you know.
I'm ignorant.
Not ignorant. You understand food from a different point of view. As you mentioned to me, it's more philosophical. Was it intriguing to be there from a food standpoint without knowing all the techniques going in? But, I mean, you just mentioned sous vide, so you obviously know some of it.
Oh, I mean, I can see an immersion circulator in front of me. Because spectators can't taste the food, because the food is really only being tasted by 12 judges. There's 24 judges, 12 for meat, 12 for fish. I'm sure that the technical aspect of cooking is incredibly important, but the vast majority, 99.999% of the people who are experiencing the Bocuse d'Or only experience it from a point of view completely devoid of tasting the food.
Yeah.
And the narrative behind the dishes, which is made explicit in booklets and presentations to the chef, the judges, that's all a part of it. So for me, that's the most interesting. It's also the most interesting to think about two guys and the scores of men and women behind them focusing for 15 months on creating these two dishes. Regardless, and that was one of the things that after they finished 10th, which was a very disappointing finish, you know, I thought a lot about, what was the takeaway from this? Did they just fail and they failed and it's 2 years of ultimately pointless sacrifice? Or was there something that was gained by their single-minded devotion and dedication to creating a dish completely well thought out and perfectly executed?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty fair to say it's the Olympics of food.
Yes.
Yeah. And it at least happens every 2 years rather than four. It's mind-boggling, the numbers that you've given me thus far. 2 days, 24 countries, 5 hours, 34 minutes after 15 months of preparation.
35 minutes.
35 minutes for two dishes.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, and beyond that, it's the amount of money is insane that the United States raised. It's, I think, in the millions.
Yeah.
But even one of the things I thought was amazing is BMW. So you serve the dishes on these platters. They're not regular platters. You know, the Team Denmark, the winning team, kept their platters covered in these big white cases. The United States partnered with BMW, and their platters were, you know, multi-tiered. Some parts of it drained, some parts were kept cold, some parts radiated heat, you know, or allowed the dish to transfer heat. Dripping pans were sort of disguised. I mean, it's a real beautiful thing that they created. That alone, they didn't pay BMW for kind of labor. They paid it for the fabrication. That alone was $23,000 for two platters being used once, and that's it.
A car's worth.
A cheap car.
Yeah, a cheap car. I don't even know the price. Zip cars, I think, $13 an hour sometimes.
Right. That's a lot of hours on a zip car.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I liked most about it. It's really absurd. You can almost say it's absurd in, you know, a literal sense, that all this money, devotion, time, you know, agony, sacrifice, blisters, yelling, drama, pain, blood, is all for, you know, 5 hours, 35 minutes, and ultimately one bite, the one bite that the judges are going to take. And after that, unless you get something out of the process that's intangible, and unless you're looking at it purely from a sort of teleological standpoint, it's gone. It's evaporated. It's 15 months of, you know.
Yeah, I almost feel like you should have walked away with a t-shirt that said, "I went to the Bocuse d'Or and I left hungry."
Yeah.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break and be back with Joshua David Stein to talk a little about his recent interrogations. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, sitting here with Joshua David Stein. I kept on mixing up your name, not on air, but when trying to initially email you, I'm like, I know it's a combo of three. I know there's Joshua. I know there's something else. I came with so many iterations of your name.
I mean, I'm Googleable.
That, well, you have to. I have to know your name to be Googleable. Yes. Oh man, that was tough to, come off with. The Beaucoup d'Or, absolutely fascinating. There's still a little bit more I want to touch on, which is the plates themselves, the dishes. I don't know if you remember them verbatim per se, but what did the U.S. produce this year?
Well, fittingly, I can tell you the philosophy and the story behind the dishes. James Kent grew up in Manhattan and in Sag Harbor. So for the meat dish, the ingredient was lamb, but he tried to use traditional steakhouse flavors and kind of a callback to Delmonico's and the old style New York restaurants. So there was something that looked like a wedge salad.
Yeah.
There was these little tomatoes, which were actually tomatoes and water, you know, lycopene is what it's called. Lycopene, one part lycopene to 152 parts water with, you know, some... But it looked just like a tomato.
Yeah.
So that was a meat plate, and it was like a loin with a lamb loin with liver, I think, on the inside, and then with a little wrap of bacon, and then they sous vide the whole thing. Looked good. And like a potato chip type.
Yeah.
There's also a potato chip looking.
Yeah.
So... It was Manhattan. And then the other side was Sag Harbor, where he lived with his family, I think, during the summers. They had a house, and it was very relaxing and very tranquil. And so the monkfish kind of played on chowdery, summery, kind of relaxed food. But it was most manifest for me as a spectator in the platters. The platter of the meat plate was, I thought, beautiful. It was reminiscent of a city grid with a lot of verticality, a lot of right angles, somewhat chaotic, but the chaos tamed by city planning.
Yeah.
The Sag Harbor fish plate was all curves. There were these things that looked like pylons and then some seaweed and, you know, just very summery. And one of the things, although I didn't talk to any of the judges about it, but it did seem to me that it was risky having such an autobiographical story. I'm sure that you can get to universal truths through the personal and the particular, but it's, you're asking people to relate to a story which is so specific and not maybe inherently compelling.
Yeah. And what did Thomas Keller tell you afterwards about the flavor?
Thomas Keller said, at the end of the day, it's only about what you eat. It's only about the taste.
Yeah.
So he also said, I said, are you disappointed? He said, we're all big boys. We're big boys here.
I'm sure there was a little bit of a tear shed for Team USA this year.
But sure, but not from Thomas Keller. No. He is a stoic Clint Eastwood of the kitchen.
Statuesque, to say the least. Beaucoup d'Or aside, your approach to food, as you said, philosophical. Also, well, like I said, it was scary for me to have you here. You know, bases itself on Q&A, interview, interaction, which it seems like you didn't have that much at the competition itself. It was more spectator and then project.
Right.
You've been doing these amazing, you know, interrogations, as you call them, on Eater, but what's so cool about them is not only the people that you've been getting to interview, but how you've taken them out of their element. It's not often this, I'm going to shadow you as you do your job. It's this really cool, relaxed environment. And bringing it back to Steakhouse, you just recently interviewed Adam Rappaport, the new EIC for Bon Appetit at Keen's.
Yeah.
How cool was that? And you are a fashionable dude and got to talk to a fashionable dude. And
how cool was that? He was... not entirely forthcoming.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed interviewing him. I think he's a, you know, a good guy. I'm curious to see what the new Bon App's going to look like. he didn't have all the moving pieces, you know, in place, so he was really hesitant to give any particulars. I would have to say that the thing I like most about interrogations, the interrogations I like most, are when you feel that the person that you're interviewing is being honest and vulnerable and really thinking about things and open-minded. One of my favorite ones that I've ever done was Andoni from Mugaritz.
Oh, yeah.
Andoni Luis...
Adriz.
Adriz. He was so well-spoken about a variety of topics. He really drew in a life philosophy into the kitchen and was very honest about his shortcomings, what he... You know, what he's scared about, what food is meant to do. And that to me was kind of my favorite.
Yeah. What was his mantra and what were those, you know, fears? And
he said something interesting. He said, when you look at a stone, one of the things he serves at Mugaritz is a stone, which is actually a potato, but it looks like a stone. He was saying, when you serve a stone and you bite into the stone and it's this amazing dish and it's delicious, you can't, and you create that consciousness of being courageous and looking at something you thought you knew and daring to perceive it being something else. That's not something you turn off when you're done eating. That's something you carry with you. And as he's also very into the community that works at Mugaritz. He said, you know, when these people come and they work for me and I work with them to become so well attuned to a spice or an ingredient and sensitive to that, when they're off their shift, it's not a sensitivity you turn off. It applies to everything else. And I thought that was really, really, you know, meaningful or powerful to me.
Yeah. You also had Juan Marie and Elena Arzak. Did they carry that same kind of influence on you?
That was a little more difficult because, well, first of all, Juan Marie is... Well, I guess he's talking... Well, that was through an interpreter. This was also through an interpreter, but... the Andoni was also through an interpreter, but for some reason the... Arzak thing was a little more difficult, although I was still really happy with the interview and how it turned out. Arzak isn't exactly as philosophical, although every interrogation obviously is different. If someone wants to just talk about technique, if Adam Rappaport only wants to talk about fashion and bone app, that's fine. I tend to be more interested in personal development, personal philosophy, vulnerability. That's my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So Arzak was incredibly interesting from a point of view of how his cuisine developed and how it fit into Basque cuisine and new Basque cuisine, but also you know, the international culinary scene. Also, Peter Meehan and Dave Chang were sitting at the table, interchange, you know, so there were a lot of people at that table.
Yeah.
All wonderful people, but the Andoni was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And one of my first ones was also one of my favorites with Eric Repair, which was like the first or second one I did. And that was, he took me into the basement of Le Bernardin and he just sat with me for 2 hours. And he is so well spoken and thinks deeply about so many things and has really changed himself. And that was inspiring on a personal level, in a way that hasn't ceased, you know, to change the way I think about things every day.
Now, speaking of vulnerability, are you intimidated in dealing with some of these, you know, icons in the sense of...
No.
No.
Because they're also people. They just happen to be really good at what they do.
Yeah.
And... I'm not intimidated. I'm excited to be able to talk to them. The one person I was intimidated to talk to, Mimi Sheraton.
Yeah.
Because she does not Brooke fools or banter. She is a very direct woman, but she's also really nice, and she knows so much about New York dining and the history of New York dining that also turned out to be a lovely afternoon.
Yeah. You've also had Mary Batali, Nigella Lawson, a favorite of mine.
She was great.
Yeah.
And that's, she's another instance where people think of her as, people think of her as a sex pot, essentially.
Is that bad?
No, she is a sex pot. She's also really brilliant and really well-spoken and maybe doesn't get as much credit for that as she deserves. And so one of the things that I think sometimes make the interrogations successful is if you tap into that which the subject most wants to talk about or feels is undervalued or you know, where they want to get out. The other thing I think is I'm a little bit arrogant and clueless in a lot of things, in a lot of ways. But it also means that I don't approach anyone with much reverence. I'm respectful, but yeah. I don't treat them with kid gloves. I hate adhering to PR dictates as to what I should ask, what I can't ask. So, and I push back if there's something that I feel is unclear or maybe incorrect or I don't agree with. I mean, I'm a person too. So in these interviews, when one person just is a yes man and kind of asks some questions to elicit these, you know, just to get the conversation flowing, that's actually not an exchange. It's like, I'm a person and I have some thoughts and you're a person and you have some thoughts. I've gotten a lot of pushback from in the beginning more, not so much anymore. Like, Joshua, we don't care, you know, about your past or what you've done. But what's important for me is that in those interrogations that it's really two people having a conversation. I don't think the reader is actually that interested in me. I know they're not. Yeah. I'm not interested in me. But I am trying to emphasize that we're both bodies in a room, you know, that we both have our stories. And I think that actually brings out some things in the subjects that wouldn't come out if I was just saying, tell me about your new project.
You know, like with the aggregated amount of media that there is, it's hard to get something that hasn't already been said.
Right.
And sometimes that thing that hasn't already been said isn't on that like article fact sheet that their PR person has. And sometimes it's not about their project or their food. It's about, like you were saying, their vulnerability, their innermost. And it's funny. I think I founded this show on the idea of the intersections of food and art. And sometimes it's loosely, you know, grounded on that. And I let it go wherever it needs to go. You know, and it organically transports conversation one way or another, but that's how it should happen.
Right.
You know, it shouldn't, I come with my notes so I can at least, you know, have a flow and fluidity to conversation, but I'm not sitting there trying to say, okay, going for that answer, going for no whammy, stop, and you get it.
Right. And, you know, sometimes it's difficult with chefs who have a lot of projects and are very media savvy to get beyond their marketing, their message, you know? But I don't think I've had any interrogations that have been marketing monologues. Yeah. I think at some point there's always been some level of real exchange.
What was the most surprising thing, though, that you talked about with one of your subjects that you didn't expect to explore?
I had a great afternoon with Rene Redzepi.
Oh, yeah. I was jealous. You spent a couple days with him, right?
No, I spent one day for a long time.
Yeah.
I picked him up after the Lenny Lopate show, and we walked through Soho and the Lower East Side. We stopped at Russ and Daughters, and then we made our way to WD50.
Yeah. And Rene Redzepi is chef of Noma, San Pellegrino's number one restaurant in the world.
He's a big dude.
Yeah.
He's a small dude, but a big dude.
Yeah. He's knocked him over.
And we talked about Jews for a long time.
Yeah.
Because he's married to a Jew.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that was going to come up.
Yeah.
And then we stopped and got lox at Russ and Donner's. But Rene Redzepi is a perfect example of someone who's green enough to, and maybe it's just in his character anyway, but he's very open and he's playful and he's smart and he's curious and he's fine talking about anything.
Yeah. I keep on hearing this of him, that he is great because he can exist outside of the kitchen.
Yeah, well, that was something he was saying about living in Denmark, is he can close a kitchen for, you know, weeks and it's fine. And
yeah.
there's not the scrutiny and the guessing game and all the pressure in New York that he had. Maybe that's changed now. I don't know. But yeah. And to bring it back to the Bocuse d'Or, I think that might also hold the key and have something to do with why the Nordic teams were so dominant, that there is this balance maybe that they have that is necessary to create food at the highest possible level, that, you know, when food transcends to become art but is still beautiful, you know, that there's some balance that they have that perhaps we don't hear.
Yeah, and Scandinavia took 1, 2, 3.
Yeah,
gold, it was silver, bronze.
Denmark, Sweden, and then third place was Norway.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if Rene Redzepi will ever be that open again. You know, I think there was some blowback from that interrogation in particular because he called Giles Corin, the critic, a nasty, nasty bastard. Which
a double nasty bastard?
Yeah, two times.
Yeah.
Two times a nasty bastard. Which then we had to publish a correction and all this mishigas, but he was great and a real mensch. He's a real mensch.
He can say that because he's married to a Jew.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Last thing I want to touch on, if you've been to the Breslin and now Spotted Pig, and noticed the t-shirts donned by a lot of the staff, thank Joshua.
You're welcome.
Now, you want to tell us a little bit about how you got into that aspect, designing t-shirts for, you know, both Spotted Pig and Breslin?
And now for the John Dory as well. Those t-shirts are being made.
Awesome.
So.
Awesome.
Well, my relationship with Ken Friedman has been a long and at times dramatic one. I think we hit it off on a horrible note because I was working for Grub Street one time and I reported on the John Dory closing in a rather aggressive manner of going to the John Dory and seeing him walking out and be like, "Hey Ken, you know, I hear this place is closing tonight. Yeah. What's up?"
Oh, you had a different voice back then?
Yeah. It was before puberty.
Yeah.
which he was unhappy about. And then we had a very intense email exchange. Yeah. Anyway, at some point he invited me for a drink. We had a drink, hashed it out. He's a good guy. I might have been a little bit aggressive, as I said. And I guess that at one point I went to a Fergus Henderson dinner at the Breslin, and I covered it for the Times for the Moment blog website. And I illustrated a bunch of the pictures.
I remember those Fergus stock drawings, yeah.
And he liked them. So he asked me if I would be interested in designing the t-shirts for the Breslin. And I said yes, but I wanted to do it only on a barter system, which pretty much all of my artistic enterprises are strictly on a barter system. I don't want to be paid for them. It's not about money. I have to credit my wife, Anna Heeren, for coming up with a drawing, which is a hipster holding a knife looking at a pig doubtfully.
Yeah.
And so I did the Breslin ones, and then you can only eat at the Breslin so much without, you know, having a heart attack.
Oh, yeah. Scrumpets.
Yeah. So I landed a gig doing it for the Spotted Pig, which has a slightly more varied menu, and now I just did it for the John Dory so I can have seafood.
What were the t-shirts at Spotted Pig?
The t-shirts at the Spotted Pig were this kind of sad-looking pig looking up at the moon, and there's a pig in the moon as opposed to a man
Yeah.
In the moon.
And are you allowed to preview the John Dory t-shirt?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
It's it's a play on the Breslin t-shirt, and it's a hipster with a shucking knife looking at an oyster doubtfully.
Does it have like a caption to it? Like by Valve?
I think it just it says no, it just says the John Dory Oyster Bar. Oh, but the other Breslin one is this lamb, and it's clearly going to be slaughtered, and it's just saying, "Oh fuck," which I wore to the Bocuse d'Or, and Team USA really liked it since lamb was one of the proteins.
Excellent. Oh fuck.
Oh fuck.
Yeah, they should just wear those at the Bocuse d'Or itself.
And then another quick plug is if anyone's interested in bespoke erotica, that's my other major endeavor. And clients give me three words, and then I write erotica based on those three words. And that's also a barter system.
How about meat? How about lamb, monkfish? And I'll think of a third one. Okay. But I think that's a good foundation.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
And that could be a whole nother show.
I've got my coffee table. Yeah. I have a drummer recorded a song based on a headline from the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's bespokeerotica.tumblr.com.
Tumblr. And also joshuadavidstein.com, eater.com.
Fake Josh Stein.
Fake on Josh Twitter. So many anamorphic avatar.
I just joined Foursquare.
Yeah.
I don't know about it.
I don't know how to check in. No. I think I accidentally checked into Foursquare the first time I signed up for it, and then deleted my account because somehow I was mayor of Foursquare. I'm like, I'm not qualified to do that.
No.
And
you resigned.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I hear there's pizza and beer after this.
I've heard whispers of such.
Oh, can't wait. So,
Joshua David Stein. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Thanks again to Whole Foods Market for sponsoring, Jack Inslee for being an awesome executive producer. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Ciao.